We have a lot to cover here in 90 minutes, and I want to make sure that, am I talking too loud or not loud enough? Raise the volume. Raise the volume. Lenny, raise the volume. Okay. Is this okay? I'm the test. We'll see how the other people. Everybody okay with this? Good. Okay. My name is Steve Ram. I'm Arts Treasurer forever, unless you guys vote me out of office, which could happen someday. And I'm really pleased to be able to welcome you to the first of the concurrent sessions that are running. This one's called Jazz and Blues. We'll be covering both of those. We have three very good speakers. First, we're going to have the pair of Vinny and Seth. Sometimes he likes to be called Vincent. Sometimes he likes to be called Vinny. But we all know both these guys. They've been around in Arsk for since the last century. Seth is, he runs his, how do we pronounce it? Epitomus? Is that the appropriate word?
I just came up with that.
I don't know. That's big fancy words. Well, he runs the Seth Winter Sound Studios. He's been doing it since 1990. He's
also too long.
Been co-chair of the Arts Technical Committee for a number of years. His remastering clients include the BMG, Universal. I think they're all merged into one company that he's worked for at this point. He's earned three Grammy nominations and one honorable mention from NARIS. As a sound engineer, he spent 27 years at the New York Public Library, and I first met Seth when he was working on the Mapleson Cylinder project, if I remember correct. Was that
A presentation at the library. Yeah.
No, I met you when you worked on that project, didn't you?
I never worked
on it. No, you didn't.
It.
Okay, sorry.
That was Tom Owen.
Yeah. Sorry. Another longtime arts member. He will be presenting with Vinny Pilote, Vincent Pilote, who most recently was made director of operations, very much lauded at the Institute of Jazz Studies. He has held a number of Arsk offices. He was president. He's been a member at large. He was co-chair of the Arsk Awards Committee. And why am I hearing applause?
I don't know. Where is this coming from?
I didn't do it that well.
No.
This is playing, not recording.
Okay. Okay. Vincent's compiled a number of jazz discographies and written program notes for a number of albums, and I'm talking way too much, so I'm going to give you Seth and Vinny, who are going to tell you about the Benny Goodman 1938 concert.
Lenny, could you hit track one, please?
Thank you.
thanks you. that's pretty much all you could hear. Anyway, that was Don't Be That Way. That was the very first number performed by Benny Goodman and his orchestra at the famous 1938 Carnegie Hall Jazz Concert. It was the first time swing music was presented at Carnegie Hall, considered by many to be a bastion of classical music. Now, even though that was the first time swing music was presented at Carnegie Hall, it doesn't mean that there were not other types of music presented there before, before Benny Goodman did his thing. So there were precedents. As you all probably know, Carnegie Hall was opened in 1891, and was considered the main concert venue in New York City until Lincoln Center was opened in 1962. In 1910, James Reese Europe, leader of the 369th U.S. Infantry Hellfighters Band, and other leading black musicians and composers, founded the Clef Club. And the idea behind the Clef Club was to provide a central union, a clearinghouse, and booking agency for the employment of black musicians anywhere in New York, and to oversee their contracts and guarantee their professionalism. The Clef Club Orchestra consisted of all black musicians, not necessarily all born here either. He seemed to like clarinet players from Puerto Rico for some reason. I don't know what that's about. usually it was over 100 strong and was dominated by plucked string instruments. They performed programs of light classics, popular songs, marches, and ragtime. In 1912, the Clef Club Orchestra appeared at Carnegie Hall in a concert to raise funds for the newly established music school settlement for colored people. Yes, we were called colored at one time. Similar concerts were held annually to aid the music school until 1915. On April 21, 1924, Paul Whiteman, the so-called king of jazz, repeated his Experiment in Modern Music concert, which he originally performed at Aeolian Hall, at Carnegie Hall. The concert presented the evolution of jazz, beginning with the original Dixieland Jazz Band. In 1928, W.C. Handy staged a concert at Carnegie Hall that made the evolution of Negro music an explicit focus as a direct response to Whiteman, okay? So he was answering him with his own idea of what jazz was all about, or the evolution of Negro music. There were other precedents that showed some form of jazz, or pre-jazz, or proto-jazz, it's a weird name I found somewhere, was performed at Carnegie Hall before Goodman did his thing. But he was the first to do the swing thing, really. I don't think anybody else did it before. The idea of the concert was someone named Wynn Nathanson, a publicist for the Camel Caravan radio show, which Goodman appeared on since 1936. In December 37, impresario Sol Hurok was approached and agreed to promote the concert. Goodman was originally reluctant to do the concert. He didn't think anybody would be interested in coming to Carnegie Hall to hear a swing band. But he was finally convinced to do it. I will tell you some things that you probably should not believe. He in his little, there's like a little promo thing in which he talks about the concert, and he makes it sound like he was all for it. He really wasn't. He said he didn't know it was being recorded. That's a lie. He definitely knew it was being recorded. The story about how the discs were found that the concert was recorded onto is also a lot of malarkey. I don't believe they were sitting in a closet and his daughter found them. So Seth's going to clear up some of that, mostly because he's got a set of the discs. In fact, that's why we're here at all, because Seth got a set of the discs. And actually, after I do my thing, I'm going to pretty much turn this whole thing over to Seth. The concert was recorded, like I said, and the first LPs were not issued until 1950, November 13th, 1950. And if I can do this correctly, okay. That's the first issue. That's from 1950. This is one of the reissues that came out, one of the LP issues. There were other LP issues, but that's the one I mostly remember. This is the first CD issue, or reissue, I should say, from 1987. And really, all they did was take the analog tapes from the LPs and digitize them and did this. So they sounded absolutely awful. And if you had the LPs, you should have kept your LPs, because they sounded better than this thing, okay? Then in 1999, we got what was supposed to be the definitive version of this concert. Well, there are some problems with this. Phil Schaff, who produced this basically and did the sound behind it, is a friend of mine, and so I'm not going to dump on him too much. I'm going to leave that for others to do. But the sound on it, it was very disappointing because he really didn't believe in noise reduction, so he didn't use a lot of it or any of it, as far as I can tell. While in one hand, he gave you the entire jam session that existed, which they couldn't give you, and he restored two numbers that were not on the original LP, he somehow managed to lose some bars in another track, which I don't know how that possibly happened, but he did, and Seth will talk about that as well. So really, what this talk basically is sort of a, this is what it should have been like kind of presentation. So I'm going to leave it now up to Seth to take it from here. But hope you enjoy what we've got in store for you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Vinny. Just to show you, wait a minute. What the heck happened here? Right there.
Yeah, use the right one.
Okay, folks, those are the discs that I have. This was done by Universal. Raymond Scott and his brother had the studio. It was in Radio City. As you can see, it says in the upper right-hand corner, it says station, and it says CBS. This is, to my knowledge, the only surviving original set of discs. That afternoon, the New York Philharmonic was on the air, and CBS radio left the microphone hanging in Carnegie Hall. At about a half an hour before the concert started, they turned the line on, and those stations or studios in the New York area that had taps to it, and they got the taps by paying a fee to CBS, were able to open up. No, CBS would flip a switch, and various studios were able to record it. To my knowledge, supposedly Harry Smith did, because of, who was the producer again? Albert Marks.
Yeah.
That's the whole story on that, and then supposedly two sets of discs were cut. No one's ever seen those sets. What was used for the 1950 issue and the CD reissue, and what you're hearing today is coming from this set of discs, which everyone, according to what I found, said were dubs that Benny had made from the Albert Marks discs. It's not true. What Benny paid to have done was to have it recorded by Universal. And even the dubs floating around, all the side joints are in exactly the same place. So as the saying goes, lightning doesn't strike twice in the same place. There's no way two studios could hit key switches in exactly the same place doing a live concert. Now, my biggest headache was, once I got it, was find the right proper archival preamp. I didn't have to go very far. Hi, Gary. How are you? Gary Gaylor was nice enough to come down to see me and drop off his preamp for a weekend. And Vinny was even kinder to come over for a weekend to supervise me doing a transfer of this. And the way I did it, and that's the back end of the preamp, which is beautiful because it has balanced outs. I don't have to go through a transformer to bring it from unbalanced to balanced line level out. And Vinny was there to help, you know, make sure I got everything down properly. And then I decided, well, what stylized assembly am I going to use? And as you can see, I used three different arrays. In other words, I used a Stanton 500 AL with the OWL assembly. And then I had some custom stylized for the V15 Type 5X made that were made by Expert Stylized. The ones on the left are the N111 assemblies, which are very, very high compliance, which give you the best sound, but they do have problems tracking discs that have warps at fast speed, whereas the N92s are a little more resilient. Here's how I started. All 14 discs were cleaned on the Keith Monk's record cleaning machine, and I used a mixture of distilled water and PhotoFlow 600, which I've been using in that machine for the last 25 years. Each side had to be manually resented before playback. The selection of styline assemblies were determined after a couple of test runs. And for the V15 Type 5 with the N111 and 92s, I found I was alternating between 3 and 3.5 mil truncated conicals. The Stanton I used was a 3.0 conical. As a result, three complete passes and transfers were done of all 28 sides. That means 84 recenterings. Oy. Thank God for Blue Moon and Sam Adams, right, Vinny? Yeah,
that,
right.
That is true. Yep.
He had it. I didn't. Determine the playback curve to be at minus 10 at minus 10 dB at 10 kilohertz and a 400 hertz base turnover. Sounded best for the playback of these discs. Did them at high res, 2496. Broadcast WAV files. As always, when I do things, I always monitor through some sort of noise reduction system, my Cedar Cambridge system, so I can get the proper stylus match. It's very hard to tell when you've got clicks and pops running around if you've got the right fit and if you're not getting tracing distortion or chatter. The broadcast WAV files were then transferred once they were put into the editor, unprocessed. They were then processed through Cedar's Cambridge system again, utilizing only the phase corrector and the two-channel corrector, and then their declickal modules. I didn't use any broadband noise reduction. In other words, what you heard was pretty much off the disc without any sort of broadband noise reduction, except just to take out ticks and pops. The resulting digital signal, now summed to mono, was routed to the SADE editor in which the processed broadcast WAV files were created. The files were then edited, re-leveled, and processed utilizing Cedar's plugins known as Retouch, which removes several and various extraneous noises, pops, clicks, and thumps. Here's the discs. Here's the second side of it. Sometimes I'm happy. This was not in the original LP issue. Two reasons were given. One was that it was too noisy, or that they just didn't have enough room on the LP side to put it, to make it fit. I'm kind of inclined to think that it was a little too noisy, because if you can play track two now, this is from the 1999 reissue, the very beginning of it. As you can hear, in certain spots, it almost sounds like it's a noise-to-signal ratio with the amount of crackle and clicks and pops in there. When I dropped the needle on this side, I turned to Vinny and I said, Vinny, where's all the noise? Track three, please. So Vinny and I are sitting there and we're going, this is unbelievable. We're finally being able to hear this damn thing for the first time. And then we run into some other problems with this recording. One of them happened in one of the most famous parts of it was when Martha Tilton came out and started to sing Loch Lomond, where the story goes is she sang two notes into the PA went out, so she had to start singing to the audience. There was only one problem. She was singing into a live mic that was still going into the mix. All righty, let's try track four. This is what the Sony restoration from 1999 sounded of the beginning.
Oh, you take the high road and and I'll take the low road, but I'll be in Scotland afore you. Oh, me and my true love may never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. By yon bonny banks and by yon bonny brae, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and my true love were ever wont to gaze.
As you can hear, there's a lot of spurious resonance in that, especially for the fact that the equalization and the playback of these discs were not done properly, in the sense there's not enough bottom in it and the top is way out of whack. When I transferred it, this is what I was able to get. If we can go to the next track.
Take the high road and I'll take the low road, but I'll be in Scotland afore you. Oh, me and my true love may never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. By yon bonny banks and by yon bonny braes, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and my true love were ever wont to gaze.
You notice when she hits that word, where, it kind of goes all over the place. Those are the spurious resonances I'm talking about, because of the fact she's so close to the microphone and everything's starting to resonate. As a result, using retouch, I was able to see where those spurious resonances were and were able to lessen them, not eliminate them like you would do with a notch filter, but just go in and just make them not as pronounced as they were in the original recording. I did this in the Robert Johnson restorations back in 2010, where he was also a little too close to the mic, whoop, like I just did now. And was able to fix a lot of the problems there when he would hit a note and the microphone would start to rattle. So using retouch, listen for that last where, and you'll see the difference. You'll hear the difference, actually. So let us go to track 6, please.
Oh, you take the high road and I'll take the low road, but I'll be in Scotland afore you. Oh, me and my true love may never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. By yon bonny banks and by yon bonny braes, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond.
Presume, I think you will all agree that's a much better result working with that in the restoration. Now we come up to the real fun one. Here comes the first incomplete item from 1999. It's toward the end of I Got Rhythm. There's a spot where they, was it Hampton and Krupa do what do they call that, a stop?
Yeah, it's a stop time thing that they do at the...
A stop time.
It's a little...
There are two of them in it. In the CD reissue, there's only one. All right, let's hear track 7. You'll hear what I'm talking about. When you hear Goodman come in, there's an edit. There's another 45 seconds after that second, at the end of those two stops, that's not there. Here's what I was able to get off of the disc. Next track, please.
Section's missing. There it is.
That.
What I don't understand is if he had those discs, how did he lose that whole section? I don't understand how that possibly could have happened.
And didn't they realize when they butted it together, it didn't exactly match? Well, whatever. What happens next? Oh, yes. The problem with a lot of these discs is, too, they at Universal, they were riding the gain for fear of it overloading. And many a times, as you're looking at the I Got Rhythm, it's really cut toward the margin, toward the label. And they usually turn things down once they pass about 4 minutes on these things. And as a result, sometimes they would drop it as much as 6 to 8 dB in a couple of steps. If we can have track 9 now, this is what it sounded like for the end of I Got Rhythm as Universal recorded it. Once in 100 years you hear that kind of virtuosity. Well, let's go on to track 10. After playing around with it and putting in the proper restores of volume, this is what I was able to come up with. Track 10, please. Now we come up to the skip that was never heard around the world originally and then was heard around the world. This is side 8. As you can see, it's also cut toward the inside. But the biggest problem is there was either a chip problem in the original recording or when a dub was made from this, the stylus must have skipped and caused a bad groove. From what I understand, Dave Jessup was remarked to say that Phil Schaps spent the day trying to get the skip out. Well, he couldn't. What he did was, and I'll play it for you off the CD, is you hear the skip, and then he edits almost the measure out to try to give some sort of musical continuity. On the original LP, this part of the solo was taken out, here we go again, taken out because they couldn't get it out in 1950. Next track, please. As you can hear, there's a thump in there, but there's music missing. Well, Vinny and I were sitting there, and on one stylus it took about 20 minutes, another one played through perfectly after I did a little bit of razor blade shaving, as well as doing an incredible anti-skate routine in that spot with a Stanton stylus. Because of that heavy, low-compliance cantilever, I was able to kind of recut that groove, and this is what I was able to get from the disc. Track 11, please. Okay. Now, with a little bit of retouch, let's hear track 12, taking that skip out. Just takes a little time, a little effort, you can get things to be restored. Okay. Whoops, sorry. All right, everybody questions whether whether these discs are originals or not. Could we have the next track, please? This is Dizzy Spells, and I'll explain it. You'll hear the needle drop in, and you'll know what I'm talking about. What you heard there was the needle dropping in, and you were actually hearing bleed through in the system on the side that wasn't being getting any signal. And because Hampton's sound was so loud and so high, it bled through the system in spite of the fact the signal was not being fed to the cutter. When the key switch was flipped over to start recording, of course, then you hear the signal. If this was a dub, what they would have done was they would have started recording that side after they had started the dub and faded up before the music would start, taking out all of that little noise. What this is telling me is that this set of discs is a set of originals. And it's very interesting to note that the previous side, they cut almost 5.5 minutes thinking they could fit it, and they just gave up and then just started another disc to get the very end of it. But this is the only side where they left that amount of noise, musical noise, that you can tell this is an original set of discs. And 28 sides worth of some of the most glorious music making ever done in the 20th century. And I was so happy and glad when I received these discs. The story goes is that it wasn't Rachel, his daughter, who found them. It was his sister-in-law who took over his apartment on Park Avenue when he moved out of there and had left it in a closet. And when he had moved to East 66th Street. And she called him and said, "Benny, you left a box." And that's the truth about that. And the other thing is that supposedly he borrowed the one set Albert Marks had, one of the two, to get a copy to Universal. The truth was he paid Universal to have it recorded. And I always say, why is this the greatest broadcast that never happened? Because CBS kept the microphone up and they kept the line going. Now I want to conclude with one of my favorites, and was one of Benny's favorites when he mentioned it in the promos in 1950, Swing Time in the Rockies. And if you'll notice too, that's all that's cut on here. It's barely 2 minutes. You can see the margin. But even on here, where they have all this room, they did turn the volume down and I was able to restore it. Can we have the next track, please?
Thank you.
running out of time. You'll be able to hear the whole thing tomorrow night. And there's the famous response when they ask Benny Goodman, how much of a break did you want for the concert? Thank you all. If you have any questions, we'll hold it to the end.